This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Eleanor Stein about climate change.
The great, really, crime against humanity is that it's going on, it's man-made, and the Republican, Democratic parties, major media, are not saying a word about where it comes from or what we can do about it.
Ray McGovern joins us to talk about John Brennan's recent appointment to a professorship at Fordham University.
Morally, what we would call this is a disease.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Devastation caused by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma have provided ample opportunity for Democrats to press Republicans on climate change. With the catastrophic storms and wildfire giving tens of millions of Americans an upfront glimpse of the types of devastation we are facing. Oddly, there's been little talk in the nation's capital. Aside from a handful of outliers, such as Hawaiian Senator Brian Schatz, leading Democratic politicians have been slow to use the tropical storms to denounce President Trump, who has dismissed climate change as a hoax. This is in contrast from past storms, like 2012's Hurricane Sandy, when Democratic New York Governor Andrew Cuomo called the disaster a sign that, quote, climate change is a reality. Even then, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, an independent, cited the storm and climate change at the time among his reasons for endorsing Barack Obama's reelection as president. Democrats appear to be heeding the warnings of Trump appointees like EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, who said recently that it's, quote, very, very insensitive to the people of Florida to talk about climate change now. Here to have the discussion with us about climate change is Eleanor Stein. Eleanor teaches a course called The Law of Climate Change, Domestic and Transnational, at Albany Law School and SUNY Albany. For 10 years, she served as an administrative law judge at the New York State Public Service Commission in Albany, New York.
Professor and attorney Eleanor Stein, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Eleanor, Houston, Florida, Bangladesh is one-third underwater. There are raging fires in the Northwest. What's going on? Is this caused by climate change?
Well, everything that is going on, in fact, is exactly what has been anticipated and predicted by climate scientists for the last 30 years, and certainly in the last few years, the predictions have gotten more and more concrete and specific. And yes, this is caused by climate change, although no single weather event, extreme event, can be said to be caused by climate change. When you look at the whole pattern, you have to see the direction of the changes, as the great climate scientist James Hansen said when he testified before Congress on this issue in 1988. He said, global warming has loaded the climate dice so that the kinds of events and the nature of the events, the ferocity of extreme weather events is going to change in certain ways, and they're exactly the ways that we are now seeing.
So what are the governmental and corporate institutions, the actions, the decisions of Trump's administration and its predecessors that have led to this crisis?
Unfortunately, we can't place this all at Trump's door, although he certainly, the actions that he's taking and the positions he's taking, of course, are, it's catastrophic, especially because we have so little time in which to correct the direction in which we're going. So the principal issue here is our use of fossil fuels and the use of by all the world's developed countries and the richer developing countries to base their economies and their increasing wealth on burning coal, burning oil, and burning natural gas. And it's the greenhouse gases that are emitted by that process that have led to warming temperatures, which in turn have led to a greater amount of water retained in the atmosphere, leading to more severe rain and snow events, very much a contributor to the hurricanes in terms of increasing sea surface temperatures, and all the other effects that have resulted from that.
Eleanor, just bringing us in the context of current events, climate advocates are arguing that Irma's aftermath is the best time to call attention to scientists' warnings about global temperatures rising and the worsening of extreme weather, such as hurricanes and wildfires that are raging in California. Do you think that Democrats have missed an opportunity to do this?
Absolutely. And I think, frankly, they've missed an opportunity, many, many opportunities over the last 10 years to take much more dramatic and decisive action on climate change. And as I was telling Michael, all of the effects that we're seeing now, which are so devastating, have been absolutely predicted and anticipated by climate scientists for many, many years. And they have been warning the world and warning our government and the corporate world, which bears a lot of responsibility here, for many years, that an unconstrained emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere resulting from the combustion of fossil fuels was going to lead to dramatic and possibly irreversible changes in the world's climate that, if unchecked, will really lead to the deaths of millions, if not billions, of people, and that will lead to a world that is really not hospitable to human civilization. And that's the path that we're on, frankly.
We know that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said recently, quote, "It's very, very insensitive to the people of Florida to talk about climate
right.
change now." In fact, Republicans who are denying that humans are causing rising temperature have indeed focused on the immediate emergency caused by the storms. Do you have suggestions? Do we need more grassroots movements to nudge legislators out of their complacency?
I think that we need to take advantage of all opportunities to put pressure both on governments and on corporate enterprises, frankly. And there is a strong movement on climate change, and there's a strong climate justice movement. But I think at this point we need all movements, all progressive efforts on all of our issues need to include a component about climate change because of the pervasive effects and the long-term effects. And, you know, the effects today are already tremendously drastic, especially in countries and communities that are particularly vulnerable to the effects of climate change. And so I would really suggest to your listeners and to you that, and to all of us, that whatever work we do, we need to find a way to link the issues of environmental justice and climate change.
In what ways do climate catastrophes affect people of color and poor people most devastatingly?
Well, you know, on a global level, of course, you have the wealthier countries of the world who bear the historic and current responsibility for greenhouse gas emissions, bearing that responsibility, but you have the least developed nations in the world and some of the poorest nations of the world suffering the impacts most dramatically. So that's everything from small island states, many of which are, you know, at or near sea level, that are, and many of which are the vacation paradises for people from the global north, are now facing extinction as land masses in the medium range, I won't even say the long run, because of sea level rise, which is a direct result of warming temperatures. And even today are experiencing the incursion of seawater into their water table because of rising sea levels. So short of total inundation, life and agriculture and, you know, economic enterprise is becoming impossible because of the loss of drinking water. And domestically, I don't have to point you to Hurricane Katrina, which resulted in the deaths of over 2,000 people. And I think as the dust settles, or the water settles in Houston and in Florida, we're going to see the communities that were most devastated, where people have the least resources to get in their SUVs and drive somewhere else, and lack of resources to get through what will be an extensive period without power, without easy access to food, and so on.
Eleanor, I was reading one expert warned that the public and policymakers should know that any planning based on the historical record is inadequate. We're in a different world. It's warmer. Storms are behaving differently. I read, for example, that by the end of the century, some scientists estimate that tropical cyclones will be more intense on an average of 2 to 11%, which to me, given what we're seeing, seems a little low. But do you agree that there needs to be a reassessment given the changes that we're seeing so quickly?
Yeah, it seems like planning. It's happened a lot faster right. than we thought it would happen.
Well, there's no question about it. The question is, can we make that kind of reassessment quickly enough and in an agile enough way, and especially in the political climate we have in this country where, you know, all the, you know, almost all the Republican governors and the federal administration are in a state of really criminal denial of what's happening. So just as an example, my work has for many years was in the energy industry. And after Superstorm Sandy, Con Edison was making its plans to rebuild the infrastructure that was damaged by the storm. A lot of their infrastructure, as you know, was damaged. There were lengthy blackouts, 9 days for Manhattan and much longer in other parts of the city. So their original plan had been to rebuild, maybe add a foot or two to the barriers that protected their infrastructure that was on the waterfront. And after a lengthy process with a lot of participation by climate justice activists and others, they realized that they had to reconsider everything. All the engineering on which their system was being protected was based on data over the last 30 years. That is no longer a guide to the next 30 years, and that is a fundamental thing for to be realized and to be implemented.
We're speaking with Eleanor Stein, who is a professor of climate law and an attorney. Eleanor, one of the things that was so extraordinarily depressing to me was the fact that the major media ignored the whole question of man-made climate change. There was wall-to-wall coverage of these storms, but you couldn't have any discussion about what caused it. Why the whiteout on that?
First of all, I think it was an incredible abdication of responsibility, and especially because the World Meteorological Association and even national meteorological organizations in the U.S. have taken into consideration climate change, consider it a major threat, and understand it. And the only thing I can really attribute it to is the atmosphere created by the Trump administration, where we're again in the era where this is, dare not speak its name. And it is truly an abdication because millions of people relied on that coverage for information, and the fundamental fact of what was going on was absolutely neglected. Now, I will say hurricane scientists and climate scientists are always very careful to say you can't attribute any specific weather event to changes in the climate. But the pattern is that not so much the frequency, but the ferocity of tropical storms and other storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, all of these storms, are driven by weather factors. They're driven primarily by the sea surface temperature is where a hurricane gets its energy. And the temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Atlantic have been higher possibly higher than ever have been recorded. And so this, your vision of a hurricane continually kind of refreshing and drawing more and more energy from the water is absolutely accurate. And also the tendency of these hurricanes to stay in place is also well known to be an effect of the changing climate. Say, and you add to that the rise in sea level, and that's what leads to these catastrophic flood events that are happening at the same time.
There are so many Americans who do not understand what you've been talking about. I think that the propagandists for the climate deniers have been quite successful in the same way that they initially were successful in convincing people that smoking didn't cause cancer. What's the level of ignorance in the United States with respect to climate denial?
Well, it's pretty high. I would say it's by far the highest in the world. And obviously, events or occurrences like the media coverage of the hurricane season is a major contributor. There are states in the South that have rewritten their elementary school textbooks to eliminate all mention of climate change. So there, you know, the teaching of climate change and the control of information is being taken very seriously, essentially by the interests of the fossil fuel industry. And let's not kid ourselves. Lack of information or ignorance is not a natural event. It is really the result of a many, many year strategy by the fossil fuel industries, the Koch brothers and others, to ensure their continued access to massive super profits from oil, coal, and gas, which are definitely threatened by the climate change impacts and also by the understanding, let me just say, in the rest of the world, that the days of fossil fuel are numbered. There's no question that if you leave the United States, you will really be on a different planet in terms of governments and even corporate understanding and strategies toward the future. European countries are banning fossil fuel, banning gasoline after a certain date, moving very decisively toward electric cars. They're investing heavily in offshore wind and solar power. Their economies are already, you know, significantly, sometimes even primarily driven by renewable energy. And that is the way of the future. And the policies of this administration are simply taking the United States out of all possibility of participating in that economy of the future, losing tremendous opportunities for technological advances here, study, knowledge, information, to say nothing of even business opportunities, which are still growing here. And renewable energy is on the rise in this country very aggressively. So that is really the good news. And that is really the underpinning here of what needs to be done in terms of countering the trends that we're now seeing in global temperature.
Trump went out to North Dakota 2 weeks ago and trumpeted the triumph over the Native Americans. The Dakota Access Pipeline is now going strong, and he was bragging about how terrific that was and talking about the Keystone Pipeline. Let me ask you, what has the Trump administration done to reverse the progress that we had made prior to their coming into office?
I will say that in spite of all the media hype about how disorganized and at war within itself and so on, and rudderless this administration is, from the very first day, they have been absolutely resolute and absolutely consistent in removing environmental controls and especially in trying to free up coal and the fossil fuel industries. The very first law that Trump signed involved removing the restrictions on dumping toxic waste from the coal industry into our country's waters. That was the very first thing he did. And really, not a day has gone by without something like that. But one of the elements that they have done, which is less known if you're not following this very closely, is that he has really systematically, undoing the entire national infrastructure for study, for collection of data, and for monitoring temperature and climate, defunding the satellites that have been measuring climate effects for and greenhouse gas emissions for the last 30 years, defunding the scientists, taking data off accessible websites. Scientists have been moving this data out of the country since day one of this administration in fear that it would be destroyed. And probably we are losing a great deal of data. And all of our ability to predict what's going to happen in the future depends on science and the war on science, which is really a war for the fossil fuel industry, has really done tremendous damage.
Eleanor, if for a miraculous reason everything that you just mentioned would be reinstated and we did a complete turnaround in terms of policy, mm-hmm. and forgive me if you mentioned this before I joined, is it too late to stave off the kind of patterns we're seeing, for example, category 4 to 5 storms, or would we sort of keep going from the level we're at, or do things get better?
Well, first of all, let me say that we can stop things from getting worse. Let's start there, which is of tremendous importance. There are some events which would make the direction we're going in truly irreversible. For example, the complete or almost complete melting of the Greenland ice sheet. Now, that's unlikely to happen. That's a long-term event. But if we reach the point where temperatures are so high that that process becomes irreversible, we are really going to be looking at an unrecognizable planet over the next 100 years. We are now in a forced march toward planetary temperatures that are higher than they've been in hundreds of thousands of years. We have to try to reverse that trend. And the first order of business is to try to stabilize emissions at current levels, which are over 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, higher than the Earth has seen in hundreds of thousands of years. And we can do that. That is within our grasp. There's no technological issue here. We can do that simply by moving off fossil fuel in an aggressive way. And we know how to do that. And it's cheap to do that. And it's clearly cheaper in the long run to do that than to continue burning fossil fuel. Now, that said, the carbon loading that is already in the atmosphere has caused certain feedback. So there's the human activity of burning fossil fuel, but at a certain point, these things tip over into kind of a cascading of other natural events, which may or may not be reversible. For example, the melting of permafrost at the poles and high northern regions. So this is land which has been frozen consecutively for more than 2 years and underlies a lot of Russia, a lot of China, and the whole Arctic region, Alaska, northern Canada, and so on. The melting of the permafrost frees up methane, which has been stored for many, many thousands of years under this kind of ice layer. And the methane is a result of deteriorating organic matter, leaves, you know, animal things that have died and decomposed, but the methane released by decomposition usually has been capped by this ice. And as this melts, we're looking already at very significant methane releases in the cold regions. And if we lose the methane level, we will also be looking at dramatic increases in global warming effects. Some natural processes, we can't really reverse them, even if we completely transform human activity.
That's because the methane traps the heat, is that right?
Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, about 25 times the potency of carbon dioxide. There's just less of it, so we tend to measure everything in terms of carbon dioxide.
So what is to be done? What's the national obligation, state and city obligations, and obligations of progressive institutions, NGOs, and the people themselves?
Well, I will say that the same day that Trump announced that he was withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, which, by the way, is kind of a fiction because no withdrawal from Paris is going to be can take effect for at least 3.5 more years. So it was simply a show. But
I didn't know that. Can you explain that briefly?
Sure. Well, by the terms of the agreement, no nation can withdraw before 3 years after the date that the treaty became effective, which I believe, was certainly in 2016. So immediately you know that no nation can withdraw until 2016, and then withdrawal takes effect 1 year after a nation files a notice of withdrawal. So arguably at least 3 years and maybe 4 years.
Good. Maybe we can get rid of this administration before that.
Well, that would certainly be a goal if it wasn't a goal anyway. But in terms of states and cities and what we can do, within a day of Trump's announcement of the withdrawal, initially 3 states, and I think we're now up to about 15 states, have constituted themselves as a kind of counterbalance, as a series of states that were going to continue to meet their obligations under Paris and support the Paris goals. It's called the U.S. Climate Alliance, and it is really is a counterforce. I think there's 14 states right now, and there are also hundreds of cities that have also pledge to continue to reduce their emissions and to try to meet the goals of Paris. And this is tremendously significant, not only because of its symbolic significance, but because the states have tremendous control over the actual decisions related to energy that really drive our climate emissions. And so aggressive action by states and on the part of citizens pushing our state governments to take more and more aggressive action on climate actually makes a huge difference in terms of the only thing that matters, which is how much greenhouse gas are we emitting. And in terms of our obligations, I think that we have to continue to put pressure on the states, put pressure on the federal government. For lawyers, there are quite a few lawsuits now pending against the administration, and I expect there will be more for its failure to, really criminal failure to take action on climate. And the main thing is that when all is said and done, we need to be in the streets with the climate justice marchers. I think that, I believe, the week after next is Climate Week in New York City and statewide, and there will be a lot of actions and a lot of meetings and conferences. And I would really urge all of our progressive sisters and brothers to integrate knowledge of climate change and the work of the climate justice movement into everything that you do, because really this will make all of our other initiatives impossible if we don't stop this
trend. It really is the fundamental question that we face.
The last time the global temperature fell below the average temperature for the 20th century was in February 1985. So that means, for your listeners who are younger than 32 years old, you have never lived in the world that we all grew up in. And that world is rapidly beyond our reach. So the urgency of taking every kind of action, including think about what you're driving, think about whether you're flying or not, think about what you're eating and where you buy your food, and most importantly, think of all the parts of your life where it involves the burning of fossil fuel, and see what you can do to reduce it.
Oh, wise words, Eleanor. I just have to say that it reminds me of that old episode of The Twilight Zone when the sun came closer to the earth.
Yeah, but this time we're doing it.
I know.
That's the difference, and
it's huge.
That's where our responsibility lies for future generations. What are we leaving?
Yes. Well, Eleanor, it's been a delight as usual, and we hope to stay in touch with you over the next few months.
Please do, and thanks for all that you do.
Eleanor Stein, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Labor Day brought an unwelcome surprise to students and alumni of what the Jesuits proudly call the Jesuit University in the city of New York. Fordham University's law school announced that it had named former CIA Director John Brennan Distinguished Fellow for Global Security. Brennan was a senior official in the CIA during the Bush-Cheney administration. The official record shows he was knee-deep into their programs of secret offshore prisons, torture, and kidnapping. In fact, in late November 2008, when President-elect Obama was about to appoint Brennan director of the CIA, a Category 5 hurricane of protest made that politically impossible. For example, the American Psychological Association publicly appealed to Obama not to appoint Brennan because of his role in torture. So instead, Brennan played the role of National Security Advisor, a role in which Obama and he worked together, meeting every Tuesday to draw up lists of who would be killed the following week by missiles from drones. By 2008, Congress had become so inured to such things that Brennan sailed through confirmation and became CIA Director for Obama's second term. That Fordham has succumbed to what Jesuits like Dan Berrigan called the celebrity virus is abundantly clear in Brennan's appointment. Fordham is proud to claim him as a college alumnus, and without a hint of shame, its law school is also proud to give him a prestigious appointment. Here to speak with us today about the meaning and significance of all of this is another alumnus of Fordham, Ray McGovern.
He is a founder and leader of the movement called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
Ray McGovern, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We've learned recently that former CIA Director John Brennan was appointed to a fellowship at Fordham University Law School here in New York City. Now, you went to Fordham, your father was a law professor there, and Fordham is a Jesuit university, one of 28 Jesuit colleges and university in the country. Like Georgetown and Marquette, it is highly regarded as an educational institution. Why is Fordham so special to you?
Well, I spent 9 years at Fordham altogether, high school, college, and graduate school. I am very grateful for the grounding that I got in a moral sense, the exposure I had to not only the classics, but the philosophers and theologians who mattered, and the not least, the ethical training that I received. We had a course in ethics. It was required. We were sophomores, which incidentally means that everyone who's a sophomore takes it, including sophomore Donald Trump. I remember the Jesuit came in, and in those days they wore long robes, and he said, "Now, look, folks, this is pretty easy, moral theology, ethics. It boils down to you do good and you avoid evil." Now, that made sense to me, but then as I grew up, I realized that was only half right. Well, we do good, certainly. We don't avoid evil. We confront it. If Jesus of Nazareth avoided evil, he could have died very peacefully as a major Hebrew prophet, safely in his bed. He confronted evil, and anyone who wants to be a follower of Jesus needs to do that. Now, Michael Ratner is one of the most great examples of precisely that. I know that he was of the Jewish faith, but that's what we all come from, the Judeo-Christian ethic, which says, if you don't do justice, then you're not following what Yahweh or Jesus of Nazareth have instructed you to do, and that is not to avoid evil, but to confront it. And so when John Brennan was given accolades by the administration of Fordham, my God, I started to think, what's happened? I talked to a Jesuit friend of mine who was down in Salvador. He took the place of one of the Jesuits who was slain down there. Dean Brackley was his name. He died of cancer a couple of years ago. He said, "Ray, you know, it really is distressing, but there's something called the celebrity virus, and no one's immune to it. And it doesn't matter what John Brennan did. He worked in the White House, and he's a Fordham alum. Come on, Ray. The celebrity virus has taken hold at Fordham, and that's what you get." So we can continue on about how Fordham has honored John Brennan and what he is known to have been responsible for, but perhaps that's enough for an intro from me.
Well, we want to refresh our listeners' memory. When John Brennan was a CIA official during the 8 years of the Bush-Cheney administration from 2000 to 2008, can you tell us what his involvement was in their programs of torture and rendition in the offshore prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba?
Yeah, Brennan bragged about his advocacy of what they call extraordinary rendition. Now, that's a neat little phrase, saying kidnapping. People were kidnapped, some of them off the streets of Milan in Italy. They were brought to, quote, friendly, end quote, intelligence services, like the Egyptians, for example, who knew a little bit more about, more than we did about how you use enhanced interrogation techniques. These people were tortured and got to say what we wanted them to say, namely, and get this, that there was a tie between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, to the point where George W. Bush, lied about this, and 69% of the American people believed, when we attacked Iraq, that Saddam Hussein was in some measure responsible for 9/11, that he played a role in 9/11, and not only that, had weapons of mass destruction, and was about to give them to other al-Qaeda terrorists. Now, That's a masterful propaganda coup. The New York Times, Washington Post participated obediently in drumming the drums for war. We all know that that was no mistake. That was fraud. And what I'm concerned about now is the people that John Brennan has brought into the CIA and elsewhere in the intelligence community are capable of perpetrating a similar fraud, this time in preparing for war. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, preparing for war against Russia.
That's what so distresses us. The war against Iraq was the greatest crime in human history. The definition, it's an aggressive war because, as they said in the Nuremberg trials, the trials that the United States instituted against the Nazis, the crime of aggressive war is the worst crime because it encompasses within itself all other crimes. That's what they did in Iraq, where they killed 1 million people, and that's what's so scary about what's looming with Russia. I just wanted to correct one thing, Ray. Before you mentioned as a sophomore at Fordham, and you said Donald Trump, you meant John Brennan, I take it.
You know, I'm really glad you asked that question. No, I meant Donald Trump.
I didn't realize that he went to Fordham.
Nobody does. I mean, you know, they kind of brag about John Brennan. I guess they draw, I guess they draw the line. Donald Trump couldn't get into an Ivy place, right? He wanted to go to Southern California to be a film producer. Fordham would take him. I imagine he paid through the nose to go to Fordham. And he spent his freshman and sophomore years there. And that's the point I was trying to make. You know, he took that same course in ethics. And maybe he believed that it was both sides were right, that you do good and you avoid evil. Well, certainly he hasn't avoided evil. But he and Brennan and I and Bill Casey, William J. Casey, who headed the CIA during its worst period, and we all went to Fordham, and so it's kind of a dubious heritage here. Some people brag about Casey. Some people brag about Brennan. I don't, nor do I brag about Donald Trump.
Amazing.
Ray McGovern, in 2008, newly elected President Barack Obama considered and then backed off of selecting John Brennan as the head of the CIA. What was that all about?
Well, everyone knew that Brennan had bragged about being part of the torture regime that he defended to the hilt on programs like the NewsHour, PBS, and so forth, Extraordinary Rendition, that he was on the routing for the memos and for the cables that talked about torture and how much you should do with the waterboarding. Should it be 170 times or 171 times for Abu Zubaydah or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? So he's on the routing. Now, what's the routing mean? Well, that means we have a cardinal principle in intelligence, and that is need to know, okay? And that applies in spades when you're dealing with sensitive things like torturing people. Now, if John Brennan didn't have a need to know, his name wouldn't be on the addressee list of those cables. There they are hanging out. So everyone knew that. Now, to its credit, the American Psychological Association spoke out in November, like 2 weeks after Obama was elected, and they said, look, there are rumors that you're going to appoint John Brennan to be head of the CIA. Forget about it. You can't possibly do this. We strongly urge you not to do that. Now, that was just the peak of the iceberg. There was a lot of opposition. And so what Obama did was put John Brennan in a different position in the White House as Deputy National Security Advisor, where John Brennan was pretty much running things anyway, including at the CIA, and participated in this wonderful Obama program where every Tuesday morning they get together with a list of people that would be assassinated by drones, including, by the way, American citizens, four of them. And John Brennan would give him the list, and Obama said, well, no, wait a second, John. You told me that Abu so-and-so, that he has three kids, and his wife is sick. Do we want to put him? Well, yes. We saw him having lunch with a suspected al-Qaeda terrorist in Beirut 2 months ago. John, look, let's put him at the bottom of the list. Let's move number six up to number five. We do those five today. Forgive me now, but I have to go have lunch with Michelle. My God, That's what they did every Tuesday. And so, you know, Brennan was a real star then. And then by the time 2012 came around, 2013, the Congress was kind of used to Brennan. You know, they thought it's kind of a neat thing to go killing people and not having any casualties on our side. And so he swept through the nomination process, lying all the time about how many civilians had been killed by drones. I remember Dianne Feinstein, the captive chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. She said, "Now, John, is it true that the number of civilians killed by drones are in the single digits? Is that what you're saying, John?" Yeah. He said, "Yeah." Well, we know there are hundreds killed that way. Most of them, like 9 out of 10, are civilians.
Ray, speaking of 2013, after Obama was reelected, he proclaimed that we must look forward, not backward. Although torture was illegal under both U.S. and international law, no one in the CIA was prosecuted. What did you think at the time of Obama's decision? Michael Ratner said then that if criminals aren't held to account, torture will reoccur. And Trump has said that he favors torture and that it works.
Yeah, well, he's wrong about that it works. It's been proven not to work. But I thought, well, Obama is chickening out. Whoa, this is a big, big sign of what to expect. In short, Obama proved over those 8 years that Brennan had a kind of hold over him, that Obama was not going to cross Brennan, and that he was afraid of the CIA. Now, you know, I'm not making this up out of whole cloth. Think of what Chuck Schumer told Rachel Maddow on the 3rd of January this year. He says, "Rachel, I don't know about Trump. I thought he was a smart fellow, but he's taken on the intelligence community, and that's a big, big foolish job. That's a foolish task because they have 6 ways from Sunday to get back at you." So I thought Trump would be a pretty smart businessman, but he's done a very, very foolish thing, end quote. Now, Rachel, of course, she rose to the occasion, and she said, "I'm sorry, Senator Schumer, you've been around for forever. Are you saying the President of the United States should be afraid of the CIA?" No way did she say that. What did Rachel say? "Oh, we'll go to break." But that's exactly what he was saying. And that's exactly what the case is. And that's what Trump has to be afraid of now, because there is a soft coup going on. They're out to get him. They wanted Hillary to win. And, you know, I have no affection. I have no part in Trump. I think he's a clown and the worst possible president we could have. But if you're going to get rid of him, for God's sake, impeach him on what he did in leaving the Paris Accord or in attacking Syria overtly without it so much as saying hello to Congress or the intelligence community. If you don't have enough to impeach him on these grounds, please don't make up these artificial reasons to impeach him, namely that he's consorting with the Russians or that he's in Putin's pocket. You don't have to do that, mostly because it's a lie and we can prove it.
In 2013, Obama finally appointed John Brennan as the head of the CIA. And when that happened, what did you think was going on?
Well, I thought that Obama was indebted to Brennan, that he was afraid of him. He'd give Brennan his head. And as we know, Brennan did all kinds of things. Now, one of the most telling things that most people don't know is that when Leon Panetta, as head of the CIA, promised the Senate Intelligence Committee to give them access to original CIA cables and other documents on torture, that happened. And Brennan was very, very worried about that. So what did he do? He hacked into the Senate Committee computers to see how much dirty stuff there was on him personally, and he was caught at it. What did Obama say? "Oh, John, please don't do that anymore. That's not nice." Now, what happened out of that? Well, what happened was that series of events showed that Obama did everything he possibly could to prevent the publication of the executive summary of that terribly damning report based on CIA cables, which showed, number one, torture didn't work, number two, that Brennan and the others were lying through their teeth and claiming that it did work. And number three, of course, the heinous practices that went on. How do we know that? Well, the head of the investigation unit of Dianne Feinstein's Senate Intelligence Committee talked to Spencer Ackerman of The Guardian, and he said, you wouldn't believe the gyrations that Obama went through to prevent that from being published. It was only published in the end because Mark Udall, who had lost his bid for re-election, said, okay, you either publish it, Mr. Obama, or I'm going to read it from the Senate floor because I have nothing further to lose. That's how much Obama tried to protect John Brennan. Why? Well, we can speculate about why, but I can tell you that is the fact.
Ray, Fordham President McShane has said that with respect to torture, there are no black and whites, that it's a gray area. Is this in accordance with Catholic teaching?
Well, everything gets, there's revisionism in everything. No, it isn't, Heidi. When I was going to school, and I think for decades thereafter, torture fit into a category we call intrinsic evil, always wrong. It was a category inhabited by rape, by slavery. Torture was the other of the big three. All was wrong. So when Brennan was invited not only to give the commencement address 6 years ago at Fordham, but also to receive an honorary degree, get this, in, quote, humane letters,
oh,
end
no.
quote. Yep. A couple of the seniors, these were pretty top-notch folks. They're both, one was summa cum laude, the other was magna cum laude. They went to President McShane and said, what's going on here? Now, he fixed it so only one of them could be there, and that was Scott McDonald, summa cum laude, okay? So he said, Father McShane, torture, that's what the problem is. And that's when McShane said, well, you got to realize that torture is a gray area, okay? Now, McDonald was not only scandalized, he was shocked. And McShane immediately said, no, this is off the record. This is off the record. Now, jocularly, he said, now, if you repeat this to anybody, I'm going to pull every hair out of your beard right now. Well, those weren't the ground rules. And McDonald was so shocked that he shared that with me and with others. We put it in print, but nobody would print it at Fordham, of course. When I mentioned it at the Fordham Law School, interestingly enough, the whole tape ran, except they excised my question of John Rizzo, the CIA lawyer who approved all these torture techniques. They excised the tape. Where I said, now, you must be real, real happy to be such a good friend of John Brennan, and by extension of Father McShane, do you agree with his attitude that torture is a gray area? That was all excised from the tape. So it's not only Nixon's secretary, it's the president of Fordham that has that kind of authority.
Ray, has there been much opposition to the Brennan appointment?
I wish. Fordham's not the way it used to be. I think it costs $50,000 to go there now. They do give a lot of scholarships to their credit, but it's a very repressive atmosphere. I mean, they even banned the formation of a club for Palestinian rights. This was within the last year. And so, they can do what they want, and people still think that they're getting a, quote, liberal education. I'm afraid they're really not anymore, and that's a really painful reality as far as I'm concerned.
As a fellow at Fordham University's law school, what will be Brennan's duties and responsibilities?
Well, I guess he'll be explaining to those promising law graduates why torture is a gray area, why you can kidnap people off the street, fly them to black prisons dispersed around the world, and apply waterboarding and other techniques that he knew about and didn't say anything against. Of course, the kidnapping, he was openly in favor of. So I guess he'll give this new theology/philosophy/ethics lessons. And, what pains me greatly, and I have to say in a weird way, my dad was a professor at Fordham Law School for 30 years. And I'm just sort of glad that he's passed on now, because I'm sure this would just tear him up to see this kind of thing happening to the legal profession, to which he devoted his whole life and which he felt very, very, very dear about. So he saw this happening before he died, but to see this kind of thing where Fordham Law... Now, you know, one thing, this is terribly cynical, but this Center for National Security that was set up at Fordham, it's all very, very interesting. You know, lots of federal money goes to these universities. I wonder where the money came to set that thing up and hire all these high-priced folks, and I wonder what that had to do with giving John Brennan an honorary degree and letting him speak at commencement and all this other stuff. You know, sometimes if you look beneath the curtain there, you can see, oh, well, all this makes sense. Fordham got X hundred millions of dollars to do this, and now they're fulfilling their part of the bargain. It's a shame, it's a scandal, it's an outrage. And the sorrowful thing, in answer to your question, is that even though a whole bunch of professors are against this and have said so, they're all afraid to be fired. They can be fired. There are only few with tenure. And all these, you know, these, what do they call them, adjuncts that the Fordham pays very little to, they do all the teaching, they are most of the teaching, and, you know, if they speak out, they'll have to go back to teach at Queens or Brooklyn College or, you know, and nothing wrong with that, of course, but to lose your job, and some of these adjuncts have two or three jobs at two or three different universities, well, that's the livelihood. They're professors, they want to teach, they get very meager pay as it is.
Yeah, they're known as the new migrant labor force.
Yeah, you got it.
And their jobs are precarious. Ray, on a personal note, if we might, you served in the Bush 41 administration as an analyst, and you've become an outspoken oppositional figure here in the United States. And I wanted to ask you, what led you to what you're doing currently?
Well, my answer is going to disappoint you, Michael, because... you know, I've been asked this all the time, and the question is, the answer is, I didn't fall off my horse on the way to Damascus, or I didn't have a brilliant insight. It was a straight line. Now, how do I explain that? I joined the CIA because the analysis group of which I was part, its job was to speak truth to power, to tell the president what was really going on without fear or favor. And during my career, I had career protection for doing precisely that. I knocked lots of four-star generals' noses out of joint by doing that. But I had protection. I was able to do that. So, fast forward now. I retire, and all of a sudden, I see my former colleagues being told by George Tenet, the director at the time, look, George Bush wants to make a war, and it's our job to serve up the, quote, intelligence, end quote, that will, quote, justify it, end quote. And I watched them, and they did it. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. After a five-year investigation, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, in releasing a bipartisan report, okay, said the intelligence before Iraq was unsubstantiated, comma, contradicted, comma, or even non-existent, period, end quote. I ask you what non-existent intelligence looks like. So what I saw was fraud, and I saw my old colleagues participating in it. We formed a small group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and we started writing memos as we had when we were on active duty, memos to the president. Our first one was on the same day that Colin Powell spread all those lies at the UN. We told him, look, Mr. President, don't believe them. Our former colleagues are being pressured into telling these. We assumed that Bush didn't know about it at the time. We assumed it was always Cheney. So we gave him the benefit of the doubt. But we finished that memo with these words. Mr. President, we strongly suggest that you broaden the circle of your advisors beyond those clearly intent on a war for which we see no compelling reason, and from which we believe the unintended consequences are likely to be catastrophic, end quote. Look at the Middle East now. look at the million Iraqis dead, look at Syria, and we'd take no pleasure having been right about that. There were other people who were saying the same thing, but very, very few, and none, zero, in the mainstream media.
Ray, we've only got a little time left. What kind of stuff are you doing now, and how can people get in touch with your work?
I put all my stuff and some other things on raymcgovern.com. And I'm glad you asked, because my son, who runs my website, is very angry when I forget to mention that, raymcgovern.com. Now, in answer to what we're doing right now, this is of significance. We have just published the bombshell, okay? July 24 was the date. It appeared first on consortiumnews.com, but it's on my website as well. What did it say? The question was, was the, quote, Russian hack, end quote, an inside job? And guess what? The answer is yes, and guess how we can prove it? By the forensic investigation that James Comey, head of the FBI at the time, for some reason, best known to him, and I think to me, neglected to do. So here's John McCain running around saying, this is an act of war, Russia, act of war by Russia, what we do? And James Comey says, oh, well, the Democratic National Committee won't let us have access to their computers, and so we can't do the forensic, so we can't really find out about the Russian hack. Well, the reason he did it, because he was in on it. Well, he's a crook, and so is Bob Mueller. They went on it from the beginning. There was no Russian hack, and we can prove it from the forensics right now. Please tune in, because we are not getting any resonance for this in the mainstream media, although we did get a major article published in The Nation on the 9th of August. You might want to tune into that as well.
Yeah, I saw that.
Will do.
Ray, we're running out of time. RayMcGovern.com. We urge our listeners to go to that now and often. Ray, it's a great pleasure for Heidi and I to have you on Law & Disorder. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, Michael and Heidi.
Bye-bye, Ray.
Bye now.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.